Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
I want to tell you about the first time I was 21 years old and I saw $6 million of cash right in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's what $6 million looks like. Insane. How the hell can I get this kind of money one day? And the guy who had the $6 million was a Jewish businessman who owned dealerships in San Fernando Valley area. And he gave me an advice at 21 that completely changed the way I do business till today. By the way, if you get value from today's message, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. Here's what this Jewish businessman told me. I said, how is it possible you got this much money and you're in your mid-30s, $6 million cash? He says, Patrick, there's one thing you need to know about Jews. I said, what's that? When one makes money, five make money. I said, what? He says, when one of us makes money in a business, five other Jews make money because we like to make money in groups. I said, so what's the benefit of that? He said, everybody keeps doing business together. He says, too many people, ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, backgrounds, they just want to be the one making money. They don't want anybody else around them making money. And then eventually they wonder, how come nobody wants to go into business with me? Because when you make money, nobody else makes money. So ask yourself the question. Number one, the person you're working for, does he make money and do you make money? And number two, the people that work with you, who report to you, if they give their best, do they also make good money the way you're making money? If the answer is yes, you're in a great place. Go do your part, and eventually you'll make your money like that Jewish mentor shared with this 21-year-old 24 years ago, 23 years ago. If you got value from this video, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And if you've never watched the video, 20 Rules of Money, How Actually Money Works, Click here to watch the video, 20 Rules of Money. Take care, everybody.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She feel like you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a nigga. That nigga hurting himself. You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Back in the year 1843, a man was born who, during his lifetime, was to have a profound effect on literally millions of people. His name was Russell Herman Conwell. He became a lawyer, then a newspaper editor, and finally a clergyman in 1881. It was during this latter period that an incident occurred which was to change his life and the lives of countless others. One day a group of boys came to Dr. Conwell at his church and asked him if he would be willing to instruct them in college courses. They wanted a college education, but lacked the money to attend. He told them he'd do all he could, and as the boys left, a thought, an idea began forming in Dr. Conwell's mind. He asked himself, why couldn't there be a fine college for poor but deserving young men? Here was a great idea, and he went to work on it at once. Almost single-handedly, Dr. Conwell raised between $6 and $8 million with which he founded the now well-known Temple University of Philadelphia. It was how he raised this money that I want to tell you about. He raised the money by giving lectures all over the country, more than 6,000 of them, and in each he told a story called Acres of Diamonds. This was a true story which had affected him very deeply, just as it affected his audiences. It was the story of a farmer who had settled in Africa. This farmer had heard the exciting stories of other African settlers who had made millions by discovering diamond mines. Realizing the African continent was rich in diamonds, the farmer could hardly wait to sell his farm and search for diamonds himself. He spent the rest of his life wandering the vast African continent, searching for the gleaming gems which brought such high prices on the markets of the world, but without success. Finally, in a sudden fit of despondency, broke and desperate, as I remember the story, he threw himself into a river and drowned. During this time, the man who had bought his farm one day found a large and unusual stone in the stream which cut through the property. It turned out to be a great diamond of enormous value, and then he discovered that his farm was covered with them. It was to become one of the world's richest diamond mines. Now, the first farmer had owned literally acres of diamonds, but had sold them for practically nothing in order to look for them elsewhere. If he had only taken the time and study to know what diamonds looked like in their rough state, and had first thoroughly explored the land he had owned, he would have had the millions he sought, right on the land he had been living upon. What so profoundly affected Dr. Conwell, and subsequently thousands of others, was the obvious fact that each of us is, at this moment, standing in the middle of his own acres of diamonds. If we will only have the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will usually find that it contains the riches we seek, whether they be financial or intangible or both. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's make sure that our own is not just as green, or perhaps even greener. While we're looking at other pastures, other people are looking at ours. There's nothing more pitiful to my mind than the person who wastes his life running from one thing to another, like the first farmer, forever looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and never staying with one thing long enough to find it. For no matter what your goal may be, the road to it can be found somewhere in the work in which you now find yourself. It wasn't until he was completely paralyzed, for example, and was forced to reach into the resources of his mind, that a Wisconsin farmer got the idea of producing exceptionally good meat products on his farm, and one of the country's largest meatpacking companies was born. His farm contained acres of diamonds, too. He had just never seen them before. A paper salesman found a dirty drinking glass in his hotel room and gave his company the idea of manufacturing paper cups, an idea that solved his financial problems for life. An insurance man got the idea of going back to all the people in his files and really working with them, serving them the way they should be served. That year, he wrote an additional $700,000 of insurance, made the million-dollar roundtable, and found he no longer had to approach cold prospects, that by working with the people he had already sold and on their referrals, he had acres of diamonds right in his filing cabinet. A man out west amassed a fortune with a single small gas station. In the beginning, when things were tough, he would ask himself each morning, what can I do to increase my service to my customers? He still asks that question of himself each morning when he gets up, and while he could have retired years ago a wealthy man, he continues to dominate the business in his area by thinking of new and better ways to be of service. Do you know what the so-called average man would have done in this last case? He would have been worried about how bad business was, because in the beginning my friend had a hard time just feeding his family. When one day a man would have driven in the station in a big shiny car, this average man, seeing the wealthy customer, would have said to himself, I ought to be in his business instead of mine. You see, the average man believes some businesses are better than others, instead of realizing the truth that there are no bad businesses. There are just those people who do not know enough to see the opportunities in the work they're in. Jobs don't have futures. People do. No matter what our work happens to be, it's our business. We're its manager. If we can see no future or opportunity in it, it isn't because it's not there, but only because we can't see it. One time another farmer poked a tiny pumpkin into an empty 1-gallon jug. The pumpkin grew until it completely filled the jug and could grow no more. When it was ripe, the farmer broke the glass jug and had a pumpkin which had assumed the jug's exact shape. In life, each of us does a similar thing. We poke ourselves into jugs of our own deciding, and we can grow no larger. But let's be mature enough to realize that it is we who do the poking, not the job, nor the company, nor the territory, nor the economy, nor the times. We do it. We should dispense with limitations and realize there is virtually no limit to our growth and development on the land on which we now find ourselves. Above all, keep this thought in mind as often as you can on and off the job. Somewhere within the work you are now doing, there lurks an opportunity which will bring you everything you could possibly want for yourself and your family. In closing, here are 12 points to remember. 1. If we will develop the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will find it contains the riches, tangible and intangible, we seek. 2. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's realize our own pasture is unlimited. 3. That there are no bad jobs, but that it's the way in which we go about our work which makes it good or bad. 4. That we poke ourselves into jugs beyond which we cannot grow. Let's remove the limitations we've set upon ourselves. 5. That only preparation can ensure our taking advantage of the opportunities which will present themselves in the future, opportunities which are around us now. 6. Put your imagination to work on the many ways and means of improving what you're now doing. 7. Learn all you can about your job, your company, and your industry. 8. Since there's no limit to the growth of your industry, it must follow there is similarly no limit on your growth potential within that industry. 9. Our dynamic and growing economy needs and will well reward the uncommon man who seeks a place in this growth. 10. Begin to build your library of reference material pertaining to your company, industry, job, and on how to better serve and get along with people. 11. Set aside an hour a day for this study and research. And 12, remember the story of the Acres of Diamonds. This is Earl Nightingale. Thank you.
All right. Today, this is a short little topic. This is something that I thought about overnight. And call it two-hour projects. Every day, we want to start and complete. We want to build something. We want to build things. Make things. And the time that we're giving ourselves is 2 hours. 2 hours to make something. So one of the things... or make part of something. A wall tent. I had a conversation with somebody overseas this morning, and we were talking about tiny houses briefly, and they were telling me, particularly in their neck of the woods, that, you know, they built to a certain point with wood, and then they used So I looked it up online, and, man, it's quite a bit out there. So wall tents, they're an affordable housing solution. And there are parts of a wall tent that we can one a day. Maybe we can do a whole wall tent a day within 2 hours. And as a matter of fact, we're not even talking about a day. We're talking about 2 hours. 2 hours out of our day to make something. It could be the floor of a wall tent. You know, the decking. We got quite a bit to select from. So wall tents or affordable housing solution. We'll get into those prices when we select a project. I got a draft of a project partner here. If any of you want to be one of them, 619-768-2945. All right, we'll be right back after this.
I was talking to a cat the other night. They want everybody looking for this. Everybody's looking for today. They're looking for escapism. Ain't it good to you? You know what? I love to get down, Jack.
Yeah.
And when I get down, you understand, I don't have to go into no funny bag. Say, I can't do this. I mean, that's what I want, man. I can't, you understand? That's the way I feel. You know, I believe I get down right about here.
Right on.
But if I get down, you know, Bud got out of sight, too, coming up. We got a record Bud right here, you know.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get our thing out of the way before Bud gets into it. Bud, come here, get down before we...
Yeah.
Is it all right? But do you think it's going to be a hit, Bud, your cousin?
Oh, yeah, it's
going to
be a hit.
You think it's going to be a hit? But I know it's a smash. I know it's a smash. Because you're in the thing, man. You're the same way as that, you know. It's got to be a hit. You ready, Bud?
This promised land above us, so much opportunity above us, but as a culture, no matter what we do, we only going to get so far.
No, we ain't got no glass ceiling. How we see it, and we've been here, and we done had every opportunity to get it. How the Mexicans come here, and they got all the big trucks, and they got the land. We were here for them.
But it kind of makes sense, right? Like, so, like, I look at myself, right? My mother, 71 years old. She never went to an integrated high school. So I'm 37, and I'm only one generation from Jim Crow.
Yeah. They had land, though. Grandmama and mama and them had land.
Facts.
we forfeited the land.
Gotcha.
Yeah, see, we didn't pay the taxes, and we didn't want to stay in the country. We didn't want to stay in the rural areas. So we had land.
Yeah.
All this land here used to be niggas.
Right.
We used to have tractors. We used to have cows. We used to have chickens. We used to have everything the Mexicans got.
Hmm. Cause I seen somebody brought the analogy at one time that when you look at Mexicans or Hispanics or Cubans, you can even say Haitians or Jamaicans and Africans, every other ethnicity that came here on their own, a few was able to come here, get established, bring the rest, they move in together, they build their own communities because it was by choice that they came here. But as you say, the nigga nation was snatched and robbed and brought here. And then, you know, you enslaved 400 years, white people were able to get free labor. So, of course, they're going to be ahead. And then once they say, okay, we quote unquote free, you free with no assets. So you really building up from complete zero in three generations.
But check this out. You have to go back to the Reconstruction era before when they was building the railroads in America.
Okay.
Black people thrive more than anybody.
Hmm.
1900s, 1910s, 1920s, black people, the black was vibrant. They had suits. They built Black Wall Street. They had Rosewood in Florida.
Yep.
We had Jones Street, 9th Street, downtown Fort Worth. So many black places, Detroit. Man, black people was vibrant, right?
Mm-hmm.
During the right after the Reconstruction era. Start thinking about, we started wanting to migrate from the rural areas where we had land and we was thriving to these new developed places that they was building, cities.
Gotcha.
Right? So we started going to the big cities, getting away from our roots where we was from. So our family members started following us, whoever went to the military, right? So we started forfeiting our land. We stopped wanting to wear coveralls, driving a tractor. We start conking our hair. Remember, we start conking our hair. We start wearing zoot suits. The jazz era. We stopped wanting to be country boys. We stopped wanting to work on the farm. Remember, we used to be construction men. We start wanting to be fly guys. So it ain't like we didn't have opportunity in this land and opportunity. We start wanting color televisions. We start wanting Cadillacs.
Mm-hmm.
We start wanting chickens. Then Dr. King come along. Right?
Right.
Dr. King say, at first they started out saying, we got our own neighborhood. We got our own stores. We want equal protection. We want y'all to stop coming burning our stuff down like y'all done Wall Street.
Right.
We want equal justice. Equal protection, equal rights, and equal justice under the law is what the rights started out becoming. They went and found a dynamic preacher who could speak real good, and they changed the narrative to integration, segregation, desegregation. Let's go join them, Dr. King said. That's when we lost. Let's go join them. Let's go eat at their restaurants. Let's ride their bus. Let's go to their school. That's what we started fighting for. So when they said, okay, y'all can eat at our restaurants. We go take the signs down. Oh, yay. We stopped eating at Mud Hill, John. And started going over there across the railroad track, eating it there. So now Mud Hill and them, Big Shirley and them, opening up their spots, but we don't want to eat at their spots. The white folks wasn't fighting to eat at our places. We was fighting to abandon our businesses. We didn't want to go to our school. We felt go to day school because Dr. King said, let's go join them.
Spend my dollar in the community. So people will argue that it wasn't that Dr. King was trying to end black businesses and integrate as far as abandon our own. It was more so that the laws were saying we couldn't go here.
Well, the laws was okay. We shouldn't have been worried about not going there.
Mm.
Dr. King didn't know what he was doing, homie. He was a 25-year-old Southern Baptist preacher that had a bunch of people telling him this. Now, always remember, he wasn't popular with that belief in the beginning. They thought he was crazy.
Gotcha.
What the fuck wrong with you, nigga? You a troublemaker. And even the old black people thought he was crazy. Why would you want to go eat at their restaurants? We don't. You know how they go do it.
Yeah.
They go spit in our food. Why you want to go over there, nigga? You crazy. We don't want to live next door to white people, nigga. You know white folk kill us. So they thought he was crazy. That was his dream.
Mm.
That wasn't for us. We weren't supposed to be paying him no goddamn mind. That was his dream. I have a dream that one day we would hold hands. He wanted to hold white folk hands. Black folk didn't want to do that. They gave us him. They picked him. So he pushed the narrative, not knowing the consequences. Toward the end of his life, he told Harry Belafonte, I think I led my people into a burning building. We shouldn't have never, we was getting hit upside our head, homie, just to sit at their counter. We don't want you in here, nigger. Why, homie? For what? So what if they don't let us in there? Nigga, we don't want, white folk can't cook no way. Nigga, who want to go eat a white person's apple pie? Fuck that, nigga, please. That was his dream because his grandmother told him when he was a little bitty boy, he couldn't play with that white boy.
Mm.
That was his dream all his life. So they took his dream and made it ours, and it became a nightmare. We go take the signs down. Just go out there and tell them something. Go out there and tell them. So when they invited him and, oh, what, six or seven preachers in the Oval Office, hey, man, go down. You got all these niggas up here on the mall office. God damn it, King, you said you wouldn't listen. They asked him, tell them we'll take the sign down. Just tell them. Just tell them we'll take the signs down. Okay, he went out there. Man, they go, well, I have a dream. We got macked on and played on. He was funded. The Jews had King. So, homie, it's deeper than that. So that's the worst thing that happened to us was his dream. We should have been saying, fuck they sign. Nigga, they can keep the laws all they want to. We want equal protection under the law. We don't care about no sign that say no colors.
People magazine a while ago.
There should be some signs say no white people.
I mean, a lot of white people feel like kind of what's been happening with the whole Black Lives Movement that has been like an inverse on them.
Well, Black Lives Matter is a gay movement. It ain't a black movement. They say they there for the LGBT rights. They don't never kick up dust for injustices in the courtroom, wrongful niggas killing niggas. So where they at now? And it's been killing like a motherfucker.
Yeah.
They ain't there for Tuka Mama. They ain't there for FBG Duck now, Mama. They ain't there for no rappers mamas now.
Yeah.
So just think about what attention they would get if the Black Lives Matter movement was doing the same thing when niggas killed niggas. Boy, they'll stop damn near black on black killing. If my tone bother you, then you full of shit.
Mm.
Right? How can you listen to rap music and that tone? Fuck you, nigga, kill this bitch, suck. How can that tone not bother you? How can you listen to a tone of a man that you know nothing about, right? And it's all this public information about me on Google, about who I really am, what I really do in real life.
Gotcha.
So what I mean by most people, if they're offended by my tone, they full of shit. I thought actions speak louder than words.
Hmm.
I don't shoot up blocks. I don't sell drugs. I'm not known for messing with children. There's no paperwork on me for snitching. I'm a father. You see what I'm saying? So I thought actions speak louder than words. So all of these people are caught up into this unrealistic world where they'll let a stranger who they know nothing about allow his tone to offend them and be okay with every other thing out in society. Just one particular person's tone, you will overlook what he really does in real life. But you'll let someone get on there and trick you with the right tone. And there'll be a woman beater. There'll be a child molester. But they got the right tone.
Gotcha.
You see what I'm saying? So most people are full of shit. So I don't give a fuck about tone because my actions are still the same.
Got you. The reason I bring that up, right, like, you know, with a text message.
Yeah.
Sometimes we can misinterpret what the text message is saying because we're reading it with what we think their tone is when typing it.
Yeah.
When we see a person in person, we look at their facial expressions and we listen to the fluctuations of the voice to kind of understand.
CJ, go get that newspaper in the backseat for me. Leave that right there. Stop that. No, leave that right there. Go get that newspaper for me. I want everybody to see this because you make a valid point. I've lost a lot of people, but I haven't lost the politicians. I haven't lost the district attorneys. I haven't lost the police chiefs because they see the real person based on the actions.
Gotcha.
You see what I'm saying? So when I had the right tone, I think I started really doing public speaking. I really started doing the motivational speaking. That's what I started out doing all around the country, working on legislation and laws as a youth advocate, doing youth justice. I wore a bow tie every day. I wouldn't dare cuss. I didn't have dreads. I was very clean cut, and I was traveling around the country. When I had the right tone, man, people weren't paying attention to what I was trying to get people to pay attention to when I had the right tone, right? If Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were alive today, people would pay them no attention because of their tone. Because of their tone. The key's over there. Because of their tone, because of their tone, right?
Right.
Farrakhan, young people we don't listen to Farrakhan because of their tone. We don't listen to the pastors because of they don't have the tone that we have. So what made me change my tune, right? What made me change my tune is because I was in the community, homie, with the children saying, look at our young brother. And this in the hood, right in Stop 6. I was saying, look at our young brother, don't do that. My words would bounce off. Say, look out. Come on, brother, don't do that. Say, come on, little homie, don't do that. And then one day, the old man who we all call Pops came in and said, say, boy, if you don't sit your ass down somewhere, nigga, say, what the fuck wrong with you? Say, nigga, sit down some goddamn well. Like, you should. So I saw how they responded to that. I was offended by how he was talking to children because I didn't grow up being cursed at by adults, right? I didn't grow up in that environment. So I was very offended, but nobody's going to say nothing to the old man. But nigga, we in the heart of Stop 6. So when the mothers come in to pick them up and we say what he done, the mama say, boy, I'm going to beat your goddamn, man. I'm going to beat your motherfucking ass. So I see how I'm observing, right?
Right.
I'm learning. So when we walk the kids home and we say, you know, hey, we want to take the kids on a field trip, and the mama look at them, why you got them goddamn shoes on? Get in the goddamn house, put some shoes on. I ain't tell you look like that. So I saw how they talk to their children in the hood, homie. So on the way to school, I'm listening to K104. I'm listening to 97.9. I'm listening to the topics of conversation that black radio have on the airplay as we're taking our children to school, and they know our kids in the car. Right?
Right.
So I'm looking at shows like Empire. I'm visiting people's households and I'm seeing them and their children all watching Love and Hip Hop Reunion. And it's some vulgar. So, man, what's wrong with my tone? But when I was speaking like this, homie, this is a law school. When I was in law school, this right here says Charleston White from courtroom to role model in 180-degree turn. This is on the front page of the most prestigious law schools in North Texas. I was on the front page paper of the American Bar Association Journal. I've gone to the Supreme Court and worked to get juvenile life without parole abolished in this country. When I was speaking, trying to tell everybody, say, man, these are one of the only countries that are locked children up. Man, didn't nobody pay me no attention. But then Eddie Murphy came with the movie Dolomite, came out on Netflix.
Yeah.
I grew up believing Dolomite was real. I didn't know Rudy Ray Moore was playing Dolomite. I didn't know he really went to the streets and recorded what people said in the streets, went home, and created a character. When I saw that, a light came on.
Mm.
I said, aha. So I started listening out in the hood to different shit. Damn, stupid motherfucker. That's how niggas talk to each other in the hood. That's how mothers talk to the nigga they dating. Nigga, if you don't get your lazy ass up, nigga, you fucking with all them bitches, you behind. So all I'm doing is repeating everything I done heard in the hood. And it offend y'all. But when I was doing this, I've been on every publication you can think of. The Texas Tribune, Dallas Observer, Houston Chronicles, Fort Worth Star. You can't, this within the last 8 to 10 years. As recently to Walter Cronkite School, News 21, just last year, the biggest journalism school in the world. So when I was talking like that, wasn't nobody paying me no attention. But then when I started speaking the language of the people, fuck you, nigga, bitch, hoe, suck my dick. That's how we talk to one another. So now the tone offends y'all. Me and y'all full of shit. You can cut it off now.
For sure. I get what you're saying, but I kind of look at it like sports, right? When you have a team, you understand your players when you're the coach.
Yeah.
You know, with some players, you light a fire under their ass, get your ass up, let's go. You cuss their ass out, and it motivates them.
Yeah.
But then you have some players on your team, that talk don't work for them. In fact, it shuts them down.
I'm not trying to motivate black people. Hmm. I don't give a fuck about black people. Because when I was working on laws and legislation, when I was going to city council every Tuesday for a year and a half straight, I ain't see black people down there fighting for black people. Hmm. When I'm down in them juvenile detention centers, I don't see black organizations down there with them kids from Gainesville, Giddings, Mart, Brownwood, Ron Jackson, Cottrell House, McFadden Ranch. I don't see these black people, so I don't give a fuck about black people, homie. Hmm. I created a program called Helping Young People Excel. What I say on the internet don't stop me from working on capital murder cases. I'm partnering with a judge right now. Shout out to Lisa Pamplin, an attorney getting ready to run for a judge. Hmm. I helped get the mayor elected in my city. You think I give a fuck who offended? None of y'all have done this work. Hmm. None of y'all have joined in when I say, hey, man, we got a kid just getting out the juvenile detention center, and I put it on my YouTube channel, and we show up here at Boss Talk 101, and he come in here and pick out whatever he... No black people is with me, so who give a fuck about motivating them, homie, when they don't wake up and make their beds? These same black people are unmotivated when they look in the mirror, so how the fuck I'm gonna motivate these niggas? These same black people hate the person they had a baby with. How the fuck I'm gonna motivate them? And they hate their baby mama. They hate their baby daddy. They resent their own mothers and fathers. How am I going to motivate them people? I stay focused on the children because Frederick Douglass said it is much easier to create strong children than it is to repair broken men. That's the fuck wrong with black people. They stuck trying to repair all these old broken-ass men when they come home from prison, when they stop gangbanging, when they old, trying to get their life together at 40. That's why these women got to go on the girls' night out and suck pussy all the time. Because these niggas is just now getting their life together and they just getting to be repaired. I went inside a juvenile facility, homie, that repaired me as a child. Where I can come out and do this. I can come out and change laws. I can come out and change legislation. If a nigga go to jail in my city, nigga, I can get him out. I can get him out. Ask Julius Williams. Got caught with some heroin. Your Honor, my client works with Charleston White in the Stop Six community. Show us some proof, Lisa. They took that 25 to life off the table and gave him 10 years felony probation, and he had just come home from federal prison. Hadn't even been out a year. So I'm effective in my village. So all the people who's affected by what I'm saying, the people in my village love it. That's why ain't nothing happening to me. I can go around everywhere in my city. Your brother tell you all the time.
For sure.
I'm loved in my city, homie. And you'll die in my city if you try to do something to me. So that's why I stay in my city.
Well, that's something to wake you up. Charleston White. And you can see if we can get more in there. But... anyway, with the comment on MLK, for me, it answered some questions because, excuse me, at the beginning, well, like I said, they were, I'm just looking at, let's take 2023 where we are right now, February 2023. All right. Me, now this is just me personally. I don't complain to waiters and waitresses. So if I don't like the service, and it's rare that I run into something like that, but in any event, if I don't like the service or the food, let's say this is my first time eating at whatever place, diner or whatever. If I don't like the service and or the food, I'm not coming back. I'm not saying anything. I'm not complaining to the waiter or the waitress. I'm not asking them to call the manager or nothing like that. If I do not like the food and or the service, I simply don't come back, because one thing here in the United States, there is an abundance of good eating establishments, from low end to high end, any type of food that you can think of. And there's no shortage of any type of cuisine that you're looking to eat in the United States. So that's just me. Now, next thing is, I'm knowingly, now this is just me, maybe I'm strange, but I am not knowingly let me give you an example. There is a brand name big restaurant chain, burger joint. Everybody knows the name, but I'm not going to mention the name. And in this one particular city, I'll say the city, Baltimore, Maryland, there's one particular location of particular brand name burger joint. This terrible service, man. You go through the drive-through, they get the drive-in order wrong some of the time, and on top of that, you can tell. Now, that's one thing about food. Pride in your work or putting love in food, the way people prepare food, if the energy's not right in cooking food, the food doesn't look right and or doesn't taste right. Because I know I went to one place, went to the drive-thru this particular time, and I didn't even eat it. I didn't go back. I didn't complain. This is just me. Everybody's different. I'm not ever going back to that place again, and I haven't. Now, once again, this is a national chain, so, you know, now in another location, you know, no problem. But in that particular location, I'm not going back. I remember there was in D.C., Washington, D.C., there was here's another thing about me. I don't like to go out and eat with a person when the service is good and the food is good, but some people just nitpick. I don't dine with those people. I don't say anything to them, but I won't dine out with them again. So, anyway, getting back to this comment on partially on what Charleston said. I really never did get the lunch counter sit-ins, because you had, once again, if that merchant's policy, if it's their policy, that they do not want to serve me or whatever particular demographic, and I'm part of that demographic, I'm all right with it. I'm not offended at all. Because I want to go to a place that wants my business and is appreciative of my business. But most of all, I want a place where if I order a burger or a steak, chicken, fish, whatever I'm ordering and whatever I'm drinking, nobody has done anything unsanitary to that food. They haven't spit in it, haven't put nothing foul in it, filthy in it. You know, that's me. Because if you force your way into something, and I'm sure people do it. I'm sure it's been done. So I never got that part of it. So I'm glad Charleston and White did bring that up. And because I'm sure in many cases, right next door to whatever lunch counter they were sitting in at, or across the street, or within a matter of, you know what, even if it's on the other side of town. Okay, if I'm paying for somebody to make me a sandwich, prepare me a meal, breakfast, what have you, I want peace. You shouldn't have to think about it. That did this person spit my food or put something in my food or whatever? And then you want to pay for it on top of that? So that's one of the things that always bothered me. And once again, as a merchant, be it at a restaurant or whatever, I think that's one of the benefits of the free enterprise system, that you have your market of people, your niche market or what have you, that you want to serve. So if you want to deal with a particular demographic, it is your right to pick and choose. That's my opinion. You know, because we're tribal anyway. I mean, we have women's clubs in the United States. Why? Because women's clubs are basically organized for women so they can talk about women's issues and, you know, whatever women talk about and whatever, you know, whatever is the common denominator, what brings them together in a particular ladies' club or men's club or teen club or, you know, language. You know, so it's so many, you know, there's a lot of variety out here on the planet, a lot of variety in life. So, well, anyway, so we'll play more of Charleston White. We only have that one audio of him today that we were able to load up before the podcast, but... You got some others that are coming to you. And yesterday, I spoke to a black township mayor. So next Wednesday, hopefully, we will have that black township mayor on. I haven't had a black township mayor on here at one time. He gave me some very interesting information, though. He told me at their peak, and we're talking about historical black townships, at their peak, there was about 1,200 black townships in historical black townships in the United States. Okay. And so that's for next Wednesday. That's our tentative date to bring in, and we're going to talk about, you want to hear a black mayor talk about black townships And that's amazing. 12. Now, I know right now, I know you got about 12 to 15 in Oklahoma. Mississippi has Mount Bayou. They might have more than that, but I'm just going off the top of my head. Mississippi has Mount Bayou, so that's, let's say, 17. Florida has, on a municipal end, Eatonville, Florida. But they're a little, there's a couple of small communities. One I just discovered, found out about last year. That's probably about 10 minutes away from me, 10, 15 minutes away from me. I think Bradley Junction. And then there's another place, somebody in Bartow, I got to look them up. In Maryland, you've got Highland Beach, Fairmont Heights, North Brentwood, Maryland, I think Glen Arden, Maryland. And a place that's near, I think they used to call it Sugarland, and near Poolsville, Maryland, or Montgomery County, Maryland. And I just found out yesterday, Colville, Maryland. In Illinois, you've got Brooklyn, Illinois, also known as Lovejoy. Well, you know what? Some people have told me they're two different places, or some people have told me also that Brooklyn, which was founded by a lady named Mother Baltimore, Priscilla Baltimore, there's a Wikipedia article about her, a former slave, and some families. What's amazing, a lot of these historical black townships were started really just by some families getting together. And then 2 months ago, you know, we had a brand new one that's forming, which is the Freedom, right now they call it the Freedom Georgia Initiative, and I'm assuming the final name, once they get to where they want to go, will be called Freedom Georgia. But that's, they're new. They're up to 502 acres so far, and they're doing campouts or whatever. So that's something that's going on in real time. So, impressive number. Like you say, that at one time at the peak, 1,200. Now, for us, I was talking to somebody overseas this morning on the continent of Africa about tiny houses and wooden houses, you know, building structures from wood. And she told me, well, you know, and this is a person that's in Kenya. And by the way, we're going to expand our reach. Now, we're going to have different day parts. This time of day, we got Blog Talk. But we're also going to do some things on WhatsApp, because, like the conversation I had this morning where I got the whole idea of tents. Because I've run across some people now that they've turned a tent into a tiny house. Or it's a tiny house, it's a combination of wood and canvas. They got videos on this. So we figured that for people that are particularly on a budget, you know, you can start off with a wall tent and then glamp it out to something like, you know, something like kind of cheeky. But we'll get on into that, but we're going to expand our, you know. So we'll be, throughout the day, we'll be doing Blog Talk, WhatsApp. For those who have WhatsApp, you can get in all those conversations. And the whole thing's going to center around a daily project. We want to have a daily project, which hopefully will start within the next few days, less than a week from now, because today's Thursday. And, you know, something that we can do to completion within 2 hours. It might be building a wall. It might be building a floor, a foundation. Might be building a roof. Might be building a complete wall tent or a complete tiny house, cabin, if we have enough participants.
And there's a not only making something within 2 hours, but making money with it as well. So tomorrow's Friday. I'm going to go through all that all the way. So, all right. And we'll go with glamping and, you know, follow some of these things that other people are doing. So on that note, like I say, I got some more Charleston or some more videos that I need to listen to. I'll get to those this afternoon. And then we'll pick ones that you might be interested in. Today we played to some of you that might be familiar with Charleston. Like, if not, you got a few videos on there. He's been interviewed by Vlad TV. But for me, like I say, interesting on the MLK thing. Where's Elijah Muhammad? He would say, do for self. So from his camp, the Elijah Muhammad camp, do for self, and, you know, they were opening up businesses and patronizing businesses that, or people were patronizing, they were serving people, rather, that, you know, wanted to do business with them. So, okay, now, if anybody's got any announcements or whatever, 619-768-2945, like I say, we're going to organize, because today's Thursday. I just got this idea when I was speaking to somebody last night. We're going to have two daily two-hour projects where it could be a birdhouse, it could be a chicken coop, it could be a tiny house. But we're going to pick a project, something that we can assemble or make or whatever we need to do within a two-hour period of time. Because like we do typically about 20, here's the goal. Eventually want to do at least two doable projects. Now, once again, it could be just a floor. It could be a wall. It could be a roof. It could be a tiny house. But the project could be a birdhouse. But the project we're looking at, it, like I said, we're going to call it a two-hour project. After the project is completed, okay, we're going to take at least one of those projects and then put it up online. Could be on Craigslist, it could be on OfferUp, it could be on Facebook Marketplace, and we're going to sell it. So we're adding a that's going to be our way of doing social media. You're going to make something. Once again, it could be a birdhouse, could be a tiny house, could be a wall tent. But we're going to give ourselves 2 hours to make it. Eventually, we're going to start with one project a day, see how that goes. And hopefully by this time next week, we'll have our first one off the ground. Okay, and we'll announce it in advance. Okay, matter of fact, tomorrow we're going to bring some. We're going to, because this is a participatory thing. What do you guys want to build? What can we build in 2 hours? A birdhouse or a tiny house? You know, what is it going to cost? Okay, you know, what's the budget? And then, like I said, we're going to, now if we have to go past 2 hours on some things, like particularly with the brainstorming and organizing funds, we'll do that, but then, you know, we'll have, you know, we got Clubhouse and all these other things. So, but we'll, you know, we'll go off to that. Starting tomorrow, we'll brainstorming, because by this time next Thursday, we'll actually, what we want to do is start by the end of the month, but starting sometime next, or by the end of this month, we can, you know, people within the audience, you know, there's 20 projects that you can make money off of. Okay, 410, your mic is open.
Can you hear me, Brother L.A.?
Yes, sir, I can hear you loud and clear.
It looks like you are starting a great work, and the thing is you need to be commended because there's not a lot of skill in our community as far as building things. And that's
correct.
The cornerstone of any group of people's existence. And the thing is it's a shame that all of those skills that used to be in our community are no longer fashionable. And you can't find anybody. I'm looking for somebody to renovate some property I got. And it's hard to find dependable people with the skill set to do it.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, as, you know, the conversation that we had offline about a couple of days ago, I was having a conversation with somebody in Uganda. Now, originally he was contacting me, you know, to learn something about tiny houses. But then he showed me some of the work that some of the people are here in his village have done, which looked pretty good. But then when he showed me a picture of, I'm going to share this with the audience now, of people, I mean, these people went into the forest. You saw pictures of it, and then they cut down the trees, and they knew which ones to cut down. They made their own lumber. I said, man, you need to open up a school. And that's when I called you, because this guy was in Uganda. Okay. So I hadn't run into anybody over here that knows how to do that.
Well,
repeat that again,
Bob. All the people I know that used to do that is dead. You know. The thing is, I think when people don't have a culture or an identity, those skills that was vital to their survival wasn't passed on, and that's one of the downfalls of people not going ahead on and setting up training like you're talking about. But you know what? If people over here really wanted to take advantage of that guy's skill, and we had the money in the community to bring him over here, then that skill you're talking about could be revitalized. But
right.
I just don't think we have the will or the vision as a people to appreciate and have the wisdom to do something like that, you know. And it's sad because the thing is, we really need to start bringing back some of those skill sets. And
oh,
I
yeah,
just don't know
time.
How we
can. Because when I saw those pictures, and we're talking about this, it's an 8-hour time difference between me and him in Uganda. I think I told you about it. In my family, I had a great uncle. If I met him, I was too young to remember what he looked like. But he's known as Uncle Hosey. His name was probably Jose, but down home people in New Orleans, that's what they call him, Uncle Jose. But he only had like a fifth or sixth grade education. But he did the same thing for family members when they got married. He would go out because there was no Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards. There was no Ace Hardware store, nothing like that during his day. So he knew how to go out locally into the woods, source the wood, make his own lumber, and build houses that still stand to this day. When I heard that, I automatically thought, man, you know what? That'll save some trips to Home Depot, Lowe's, and Menards. And then, you know, as we were speaking, Frederick Douglass, Not Frederick Douglass. No, yeah. Wait a minute. Booker, no, not Frederick Douglass. Booker T. Washington. You know, Tuskegee, which is Tuskegee University now, started out basically their first book. It started with a shack or a shed or something like that. But then when he was still alive, they learned how to make their own bricks. Then they learned how to make their own nails. They weren't good at it at first. But when he was alive, he was big on, along with the academic side of education, you know, you need an industrial, as he would call it, an industrial side of education. So after that conversation we had, I tracked down a salesperson and a company and a salesperson where they have machines that make nails. So, but I've witnessed maybe one person over here that can identify a tree and make some lumber. But he just did it with just a little piece of wood. But what I saw through this guy from Uganda yesterday, it was, and he broke down the whole process of chopping down a tree, identifying a tree, curing it, you know, the time it takes, and then show what they built from the lemon that they had made. So, that's when the idea came up, like, between talking to you and all that. It's, you know, if we can, because I went on Pinterest, and there's a lot of woodworking projects, and they don't have to be just wood, they can be metal too, but there's a lot of things that people can make within 2 hours or less, all right, and particularly if you plan it out. So I figured if we have something 2 hours a day and we have it in more than one location, okay, because we have the technology now. We got smartphones that give good quality pictures, desktops. The technology, the teaching tools, the sharing tools. I had this conversation with a guy in Uganda yesterday. I mean, you know, the same day, last time I talked to you. This morning, I had a conversation with a young lady. She taught herself carpentry, and she's out of another East African country. So, the hands-on thing, I think, is imperative. You got to give people, and I know we're not going to get a whole lot of people on it, but there's quite a few people that if you watch YouTube and use it as your barometer, there's quite a few people that are teaching themselves how to convert a car into a tiny house or convert. I mean, I saw a guy who converted a tent into a tiny house. But it could be cooking. We talked about Mignon Francois on here several times. She did her thing with cupcakes. That's what she does. That's what she makes. So we're going to get into the making thing because I believe if you learn how to make something, it'll be a game changer in your life.
It is a game changer for those that want to be free in the society. Now,
right.
As you were talking, I was thinking, I bet you the Freedom Georgia people have never thought about what you were talking about. Now, I don't know what type of trees they have on their property.
They got a lot of them.
The thing is this. That would be something that if they could be interested and have the vision and
right.
have the trees, that would be something that would really help them to establish whatever they're trying to do. But now there's an art. Like you say, your Uncle Hosey, there's an art to picking those trees out. And there's an art to going to get all and getting them cut. Now, the way I understood it with the elders in my community was they cured that lumber. They didn't just cut that tree down and start building. They cured that lumber.
Yeah.
And
now, the guy in Uganda told me that, too. Yeah, they cut it down, and then they cure it. Yeah, they don't start building right away. They cure it first.
That's right. And that's why come the buildings that they put up a long time ago still standing, because now what they do is they just cut the trees down, and they don't cure the trees before they turn it into lumber. And that's why you have some of the problems that you have with these buildings today. But people like that Freedom Georgia crew, if they had the mindset, and I don't think they do, to go in and say, well, you know what, we got the trees here. We got the land, we got the trees. That type of machinery that is used to turn trees into lumber, you can more or less, you can set that up yourself. It used to be. Now, I don't know how it is now, but the people that I knew that used to do that, they made their own apparatus to do that. And it's really not that hard to do. But, you know, it's just that, Brother L.A., we are a mess. I don't see our people surviving this thing, because if we don't get a hands-on mentality, it's going to be over. It's going to be over, and I see it coming. And it's sad to say that, you know, I'm helpless to try and figure out how to get it done. I'm going to be honest with you.
Well, I think if you look at it, like I say, with the Freedom Georgia Initiative, you know, it started, like, well, they were on here, like, say, 2 months ago when we got it in the archive. Started with three women, so they got 19 families together. Well, now, here's the critical point before we get to that. They realized, and this is what one of the things, critical things I like about the Freedom Georgia Initiative. They realized that, okay, they live in Metro Atlanta, and they're not going to fix or live long enough to fix Atlanta's problems. Now, it's just not Atlanta. It could be D.C., Chicago, Illinois, Orlando, Seattle. You know, so they said, you know what? They had the opportunity, and they seized it, you know, land 2 hours away, and they bought that 96 acres and said, you know what? Instead of trying to fix somebody's other city's problems, because every city is made up of a lot of communities, let's just start our own community. And that's what I really like about them. So with that, you know, they've had now they do have one guy in the group that, or connected with the group rather, where if you want to learn how to build your own house, now I think they're regular size houses now, I don't think tiny houses, but whatever. He takes on no more than 10 students. Now, they mentioned he charges $3,000. I don't know if that's $3,000 for all 10 people or is it $3,000 per person. But they do have that. But in a conversation that I had with him, which is recorded right here on Blog Talk, what you brought up, because they got a lot of trees on that property. And that could be a cottage industry by them harvesting their own trees and making their own lumber. So,
well,
you know, that did not come up in the conversation.
No, but, you know, even if they don't make it a cottage industry, I'm quite sure they're going to be building on that property. And they could save themselves a lot of money. And they could get the quality of materials that they want by doing that. But like I said before.
And see, since, like, I don't know how many families they have now, Beasley, but they started with 19. And what I liked about it is it's generational. You got grandparents, children, grandchildren. They're all – it's all there. And those skills, what you're talking about, that can be taught to the youngins. And that's going from generation to generation to generation. Exactly. It'll be multi-generation.
That's right. That's right. But there again, look, when you don't have an identity and a culture, what you and I are talking about is foreign to our community. And that's the sad part. Because
with the Freedom Georgia Initiative, don't you think they have an identity already within that group?
They have the identity and they have the vision to get the land, but as far as what you and I are talking about, they don't have the vision to go in and make that an industry. They're just looking for somewhere to live. You see what I'm saying? And you know what? Right. That's not unique to our community. What the elites have done in this country is they have steered and conditioned people to, hey, I want mine right now, and I don't want to get my hands dirty. And, hey, look, as long as I get everything centralized where I can control it, I can control your lifestyle, your money, and your thinking. And that's the problem now. So that's why I was saying
it's interesting. You're saying, I had a conversation with Viata yesterday, and she was basically saying the same thing you're saying. A lot of people in our westernized culture, regardless of race, color, religion, we want that. We want it right. We want it yesterday, some of us.
Yeah.
But you know what? I believe, like I say, thanks to YouTube, I'm using that man as a barometer. There are plenty of people out here that are, because I'm looking at, we're in the age of, I don't know if you want to call it hyperinflation yet, but inflation globally is kicking everybody in the behind around the globe. So I'm looking at, you know, in order to get ahead of the curve and stay ahead of the curve, man, I got to pick up some new skills. For me, it's carpentry. And now, I mean, look, a month ago, a week ago, I wasn't even thinking about, all right, can I get a machine that knows how to make nails? I wasn't even thinking that way. I'm thinking that way now. You know, because, you know, and then starting off small, you know, like we pick a project that we can complete within 2 hours. And like I say, to start off, it just might be a birdhouse. But, you know, sell that stuff too.
Well, I told you about when I was in school, they used to teach carpentry.
Right.
And what happened is, you know how they taught people to build a house. Do you know the process that they use to teach people how to build a house?
I'm asking you what.
What happened is it started off with building a doghouse.
Okay.
And if you could build that doghouse and you could cut the lumber in, you know, and do the wall in and everything else, then you could build, they'd graduate you to a bigger structure. That's how they
use it. That makes sense. That,
yeah.
You know, and we'll probably follow that same path right here. Start off with something simple.
Yeah.
And hands-on and like say, go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, a birdhouse, but what they did, they said, well, look, we're going to build a doghouse, and they'd go ahead and do the rafters and everything else and show you how to put it up, and then they scale you up. And
right.
What happened is we used to support our school like that. Well, I didn't take carpentry because I was an idiot. You know, I wanted to go to college. So I was taking, you know, advanced classes and everything. But the guys that did take that class, they made a good living because they show you how to dig the foundation. They show you how to square your corners up and everything else. And plus, brick masonry was a part of that course too. And the trick is, the guys that took that course, they never worked for anybody but themselves. And that's the way they do it. But the thing is, what you're talking
about, share with us what you shared with me a couple of days ago. You made your grandmother some furniture. Tell us about that.
I made my grandmother a bedroom set, and that was part of my class project. Each one of us had a class project that required us to work with wood, and I made a chest of drawers. I made the dresser. I made the end tables, and I made the bed frame and everything. All she had to buy was the mattress. In fact, I made the lamps to go on the end tables, too. And my grandmother bragged about that until she died, man. She had to show everybody what I'd done. And look, I even stained it and you know, varnished it and everything else, you know. So, you know, they taught me some skills, but the thing is, I didn't know the importance of it or what I was doing because, hey, you know, we were trained, hey, look, go to college, and, you know, you can get your office job. You know, that's the way we were trained.
Right.
And unfortunately, now that I'm this age, I see what my shortcomings were back then because what I should have done was stuck with it. And when I needed something done, I would have been able to do it and save myself a lot of money. But you don't know when you're young.
You don't. But, well, we know now, and we're healthy enough now, so that's what I'm you know, looking at and whatnot. Let's see. Let's bring on Chris Collins real quick. 309, your mic is open.
Good morning, Brother L.A.
Good morning. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too. I was listening to who's the other gentleman with the four that called in right before here? That's on. Was that the gentleman out of Chicago?
No. This is a Brother Beasley. He's in another state. Speaking about the people out of Chicago, they've been having health problems. I used to hear from him every morning, but I haven't heard from him in the last 5 days, and I've been reaching out, but nothing's come back, so hopefully he's all right. He looked like he was having some health problems, but no. Brother Beasley is in another state, not Illinois.
Well, I heard that he had a few houses that he needed to remodel, and he was having a problem finding people. I was wanting to see where he was at and see if I could go help him.
Oh, well, he's on the line. You can ask him directly yourself. But Beasley heard it.
Yeah, I heard him. What happened is I'm in the process of buying that property. And once I get it, yeah, I'd be glad to hook up with you.
Yeah, definitely. What state are you in?
Huh?
What state are you in?
I'm in North Carolina.
Oh, see, you're even finding it better. Yeah, that's where my family's at. So, if you get the property and you need to have the work done, let me know. I have.
Okay, I get in contact with you through LA.
Through LA, that's fine.
Yeah, once this thing is closed. Let me get back with you. Hold on.
Here, Chris, you've been hearing the conversation. We're, can you think of any, small projects that we can help get people started on making on? So, like, we want to have something, ideally, where we get to the point where we're making something every day.
Oh, yeah.
And training people how to make things.
Yeah, I was liking the conversation, you know, and you said something about birdhouses even. I used to make birdhouses. And if you make them out of cedar, I'll just give people a hint. If you make them out of cedar, when a bird comes and houses in it, any bugs that are on the bird will leave the bird because cedar won't let bugs, the bugs won't live in it. So,
did not
know
that. Okay.
This is a, I used to build a little church and then I built a log cabin. And you can, and all it really takes is a little air brad nailer to put them together.
Okay.
You have the shake, looks like shake shingle roofing. The only thing that you have to do any precision cuts on is that little steeple that goes on top of the church.
Uh-huh.
Everything else, either I actually used to cut the material and just put it together in a little box. And I would send it to people. They could buy the little package that was pre-cut for $10. Or they could buy one already assembled for $20. If they bought two of them assembled, I would give them to them for $30.
Okay.
But what I did was I gave them everything cut, so all they had to do was put it together. So there's many ways, you know, a lot of these different little projects that are out there that just need put together. You can go and buy all the material to it already pre-cut and make things. Now,
yeah,
anybody
man,
that wants to do any kind of
things,
printing?
And then, yeah, making things as a group project, and then let's say we make two or something, or what it might be, and sell it, you know. Show people how to make it, then
yeah.
Sell it, then that brings in revenue for people who want to participate.
You know, when using that model of the lady that has the video and when somebody, she'll go live and then people will order things and she'll turn right around and make your order right in front of you and package it up and send it out. You know, one of the things I saw.
There's two of my favorite YouTubers. What's her name? She's like 27 to 28 years old. She's a seamstress. Man, she and her husband have built that thing up to be a $1 million business. Just out of her house. Just sewing stuff. But she'll do a live stream on YouTube. And then now there's another guy. He's not into it. He has stuff made up, you know, like baseball hats and T-shirts and all that. But he'll do a live stream, and then you see him taking orders on the live stream. So that's the kind of thing what you're talking about. Like I would like us to do. So if they see something being made, because some people, I mean, they don't want to learn how to make, but that's fine. But they want the end product, or they'll assemble it. You know, and they'll still order. So that's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, and, you know, you can even get to the artistic parts. A package showed up at a friend's house yesterday. His sister takes those tumblers that you drink out of, and she's an artist, and she'll make it your own. So I was sitting there thinking about her in that model. Of going online, you know, doing live, making one of the tumblers. It doesn't matter. She's an artist and she'll make it unique to what you ask for. But she can make them 3D. She can just put pictures behind them, and you know, you're just looking at your loved ones all day. Anything you want on it, she can make have happen. So you know, it was another creative thought process of, you know, what artists are out there doing. So, you know, those things normally cost you somewhere about $20 to $30 by themselves. And
right.
You know, she's like $30, $35. She gives you one that's a one of a kind. So you might have, you know, a tumbler from one of the major brands that they've got out there, but she'll take that tumbler and make it yours. And
right.
it was pretty amazing when I saw the one that showed up yesterday. You know, this guy's like, I want to show that I'm a king. Well, she put a crown around the top of it where the drink straw is, and has a picture of him with a crown on, you know, through it, and then has his little side name down the side of it in gold. And even has an earring, 3D earring, you know, so the little stone sticks out of it right in the ear of the picture. So okay. It's quite cool. So just any kind of idea like that, you know. I mean, it don't have to be a construction item. It could be an artistic item. It's more.
You can be.
Yeah, it's more using your imagination, because every one of you are going to have a thought that's out there, and that thought can be made to brought to monetary product, and that's a fact. That's why we want to do this with our children, teach our children that, hey, what are you thinking? You know, what are you playing? What do you don't like about it? What could we fix about it? And each of those things, you know, people make products better all the time. So
that's true, it depends on how you organize it, because a lot of towns historically around the globe grew out of basically people that they were making something. I mean, Hershey, Pennsylvania, that was Hershey needed a place, a physical place where his employees could live and all this. Thus, you got Hershey, Pennsylvania, which serves this. It is a bunch of towns all across the globe. In China, you've got, and I'm sure they have over here in the United States too, villages, they just might make neckties or belts or whatever. But, you know, it's the same, you know, Native Americans over here, you know, they set up a casino or resort or whatever. So, well, anyway, tomorrow we'll do some brainstorming, probably look at Pinterest, come up with something simple so we can get started over the weekend and go from there. Chris, any other announcements that you want to put out there?
No, I don't believe so. I did take and got the ACN stuff off my stuff, and I've got BAMCO on my stuff now. So I did get lined up with them.
Okay.
And
all right.
That's about it.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, I don't know if Beasley, you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, he might. Yeah, we can. Anything you want to put out there before we sign off for today? Yeah. I can't. Beasley, you there?
Beasley, you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh, I'm in the car riding, and I'm having problems with, I'm hooked up through the car dashboard. But no, I don't have anything I want to put out there.
Okay, all right then. Well, I'll catch you later on this afternoon. But we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll see you guys tomorrow, and we'll start bringing some on projects. Like I say, every day, something that we want to make and get it out there.
I do want to make
an announcement. Oh, wait a minute, Chris. Oh, doggone. Wait a minute. Wait a minute if I can get Chris back. Okay, wait a minute. We're not gone yet. Let me see. Chris, let me track him down. Okay. Let me see if this will work. Call back in. Okay. Let's see if he'll call back. Sometimes they let you call back in, sometimes they don't. Okay, I've refreshed my board. And because we do have 5 more minutes recording time. All right, if he calls in, fine. If not, okay, let me. I just sent him a text. I know he's got that, but sometimes they don't let you call back in, though. When it's this late, late in the, okay.
So I'm getting back to my outro music. If he doesn't call in by the time I get back to that, which I'm almost there, then we'll catch him tomorrow. Okay. Don't seem like the system's letting him back in on that note. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow. See you then.